Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Medicine. I am your host, Jeremy Corr. Today, we will be talking to Dr. Paul Offit. He is here today to talk about his book, Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Sources of Health Information. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm trained in pediatrics, but spent most of my time in a basic science laboratory doing virology and immunology, and was fortunate enough to participate with a team at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia that ultimately created the strains, the so-called bovine human reassortant rotavirus strains that became the vaccine Rotatec in 2006, which was licensed and recommended for all children in this country then, and then by the World Health Organization for all children in the world in 2013. So I guess at my heart, I'm a basic scientist.
What inspired you to write Bad Advice?
Well, I think now more than ever, it seems that people are simply declaring their own truths. So vaccines cause autism, creationism and evolution are equally valid hypotheses, climate change is real. And I think that the best people to address those concerns are scientists. But unfortunately, speaking as one, I can tell you that my training as a scientist in many ways was the opposite of the training that you need to do to, I think, try and be convincing and passionate and compassionate with the public. And so that's why. I mean, another more reasonable title, frankly, for the book could be how to communicate science to the public or die trying.
Well, one thing I find interesting is for me, and I think a lot of people out there, it's common sense. You know, I'm not going to get my health advice from a celebrity or politician or anything like that. That seems silly. So, but for a lot of people, that's unfortunately not the case.
Well, I mean, you know, they don't pick scientists to sell products. You know, if you look, for example, at a variety of products on television, invariably it's celebrities that sell them, even though they presumably have no specific training or education on that particular product. But the point is they're a familiar face. They're a face that you've come to trust because you've seen them on the big screen in the movies or on the little screen on television. And so you think you know them. I mean, when Jim Carrey, for example, is on television, you think you know him based on the roles that he's played, even though he will have no specific expertise often on what he's talking about, as he did when he was on Larry King Live disparaging vaccines. Still, he becomes an important voice because you think you know him.
The first chapter in your book discusses what is and what isn't science. You talk about how some people who say you can't trust science gets it wrong all the time, They can provide examples of times when science has, or when scientists have been wrong, such as with lobotomies or cold fusion. You say, though, that it is reasonable to be skeptical of scientists, but unreasonable to be skeptical of the scientific process. Can you please talk about this for our listeners and share how it relates to your discussion with Senator Tom Harkin?
Sure. I mean, science is a process whereby you're constantly probing nature, trying to understand nature. And not shockingly, there's always fits and starts in that understanding. And occasionally you may have a hypothesis which you think you've supported with data, but then others are unable to reproduce that. That's the nature of the scientific process. We learn as we go. So you're right. I mean, Egas Moniz was a Portuguese neurologist who in 1935 won the Nobel Prize for what he called leucotomy, what he believed was a surgical cure for a variety of psychiatric illnesses, and went across the Atlantic Ocean. It was called lobotomy, and we did 20,000 lobotomies in the United States and did far more harm than good. And I think, you know, people will look at stories like that and say, see, you can't trust science. So I think an even better story, the more relevant story, is Ansel Keys, who in 1957 put forward what he called the heart-healthy diet, at the center of which was margarine. He believed that animal fats were bad because they were saturated, and we needed unsaturated fats like, you know, partially hydrogenated vegetable oils that were contained in margarine, which were loaded with trans fats. And as we now know retrospectively, probably accounted for as many as 250,000 cardiovascular related negative events a year until we eliminated trans fats, because we learned what they could do to bad cholesterol, so-called very low-density lipoprotein cholesterol. And people say, see, this guy was an advisor to the United Nations. He was a major player in the world of nutrition, and he was dead wrong. And that's right. But the point is, we ultimately learned that he was wrong. And that's the way science works. I think for me, the episode you're talking about with Tom Harkin, I went with a group of people, including Betty Bumpers, who was the wife of Senator Dale Bumpers, and as well as Amy Pisani, who's a group called Every Child by Two, to talk to Tom Harkin, a popular Democrat from Iowa, right, your home state, whereby he wanted to sort of put aside a lot of money, actually, to try and look to see whether vaccines as they were currently given cause permanent brain damage. The fact was, many studies like that had already been done. Two, biologically, it was implausible. And three, it just didn't seem like a very good use of money for this particular purpose. So I was there to kind of try and educate him about the studies that were done. As we were leaving, I was the last to leave the office, and he wouldn't let go of my hand. He kept holding onto my hand and staring into my eyes. And he said, you know, why should I believe you? You know, I've had other people who've come into my office who've told me exactly the opposite of what you've told me. And I said, well, it really doesn't matter what I say. And the only thing that really matters is what the data show. By doing that, by saying that, what I was asking him to do was to look at all the studies and rate, weigh their relative value, something he's unlikely to do, or frankly, to have the expertise to do. So he did what most people do. He just wanted to see whether he could trust me. As it turns out, he did. And he didn't end up setting aside that money. But I think we won. I think children won in that interchange. But the fact is that I won for all the wrong reasons. I won because I looked like the kind of person he should trust, whereas really it's the data that and the reproducibility of the data and the robustness of the data that he should trust. So it was a little unnerving. And it basically what it taught me is that, you know, scientists who have winning personalities but not necessarily very good data can win over a scientist, for example, who's more awkward but has better data. It's unfortunately true that science doesn't speak for itself.
Let's talk a bit about this. So, you know, what are some of the stereotypes and struggles scientists deal with when communicating with the public? You say that in spite of these stereotypes and struggles, scientists are indeed good storytellers. Can you please talk about this for our listeners?
Well, when you publish a paper, you submit it to a good journal, and you want them to publish it. In order to do that, you have to, at some level, be a good writer and a good storyteller. That why, not only that your data are valuable, but why they're valuable, well, how they fit into a larger narrative. Similarly, when you write a grant, and grants are hard to come by from NIH or NSF or wherever you're trying to get money from, you have to be able to tell a story more compelling than those who are also seeking this limited amount of funds. So I think at some level we are good storytellers. Unfortunately, the titles of our paper read something like, you know, a molecular basis of rotavirus virulence, role of gene segment 4, not Disco Bloodbath, which I think is probably a more compelling title. But that said, I do think we have it in us. I think if you look at scientists who are great storytellers, like Isaac Asimov or Jacques Cousteau or Galileo or Louis Pasteur, those guys and gals were all good storytellers. I just think we have to sort of channel that inner storyteller that I think we all do have.
And scientists are also compelled by good stories. Can you talk about what compelled you to work with rotavirus?
Sure. I mean, I was a resident in pediatrics at Children's Hospital in Pittsburgh when, as a second-year resident, there was a child who came in who was about 9 months old. It was a little girl who had gotten sick the night before with fever and vomiting. She hadn't even really started to have diarrhea yet, which is also typical of this particular viral infection, rotavirus. And she was great, the mother. I mean, she was a typical salt-of-the-earth kind of mom who had called the doctor the night before. The doctor had told her to give frequent sips of fluids containing sugar and salt, which she could make at home. And she did all that. She tried to do that. The problem was is that the child was vomiting, so she couldn't get this little girl to hold anything down. By the time she finally came into our hospital, she was severely dehydrated. We tried to get an intravenous catheter into her arms or legs, but she was too clamped down because she was so dehydrated, so we couldn't find them. What we ended up doing was taking a large bore needle, the kind of needle you use for a bone marrow, and it put that into her bone in the hopes that we could get fluids into her bone, which would then be resorbed into her circulation, which could save her life, while we called a surgeon down to come down and put a catheter into her neck, which we were uncomfortable doing. By the time the surgeon got down, there was too late. The little girl had died of shock from a critical loss of fluid. We were unable to resuscitate her. And then comes the worst moment you can deal with as a pediatric resident. We had to go walk outside and tell a mother of a nine-month-old girl who was perfectly fine 2 days earlier that her child had died. And that always stuck with me. And I remember going to the library that night to look up what was known about rotavirus gastroenteritis, or said another way, how rotavirus causes, inflammation of the stomach and small intestines. And the title of the paper was Fatal Rotavirus Gastroenteritis in the United States. And I hadn't realized that rotavirus could be fatal in the United States, where in theory access to medicine is much better. And we have intravenous fluids readily available as distinct from the developing world. And that was an image that was always in my mind during the 25 plus years that we were working on a rotavirus vaccine at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
One of the other things we talk about is how scientists often think a little bit differently. They're great with their level of expertise and they see it in areas that other people normally wouldn't. Can you talk a little bit about Neil deGrasse Tyson in the movie Titanic?
What he did was he saw that when towards the end of the movie, Rose and Jack were sort of floating, although she was floating on a board and he wasn't, although I still don't understand quite why he couldn't also fit on that board. But that aside, when they were looking up at the sky, he realized that that's not what the sky would look like in that hemisphere, in that year, at that time of the seasons. And so he wrote James Cameron, who was the executive producer, to say that that was the wrong sky. And ultimately, James Cameron, changed that for the 3D version of the movie. But, how many people watched that movie and thought, wait, that's not what the sky would have looked like in 1912 in that hemisphere? Just Neil deGrasse Tyson. But, it just shows you how scientists are largely intolerant of scientific inaccuracies.
Can you talk a bit about how scientists can't use the word prove or the P word? And how has this been misunderstood by the non-scientific community? Can you include how this has had an effect on the public's understanding of the MMR vaccine and autism?
Sure. If you're doing an epidemiological study, you can show whether one thing is associated with another at a certain level of statistical power. So here's what I mean. The way that scientists work is they formulate a hypothesis, and specifically in an epidemiological study, it would be the null hypothesis. So in this case, it would be the combination measles, mumps, rubella, or MMR vaccine does not cause autism. That's the null hypothesis. You can reject it, which is to say that when autism follows receipt of the MMR vaccine, it would be at a level greater than would be expected by chance alone. You cannot reject the null hypothesis, which means that when autism follows receipt of the MMR vaccine, it would be at a level that would be expected by chance alone, but you can't accept the null hypothesis. You can never prove never. And I think scientists know that. So for example, I mean, when I was a little boy, I used to watch the television show Adventures of Superman, where Superman flew. And I tried when I was a five-year-old to put a towel around my neck, to jump from a small height, to see whether I could fly unsuccessfully. Now, I could have tried a million times. That wouldn't have proven I couldn't have flown. It would have only made it all the more statistically unlikely. That's also true here. You can only say that MMR is not associated with autism to a certain level of statistical power. And when I had to testify actually in front of Dan Burton's subcommittee when he was head of the Office of Government Reform, Burton was a Republican from Indiana back in the early 2000s, I knew, as did the other scientists who were sitting on that panel, that you can't say MMR doesn't cause autism. But, you know, what ended up happening, and it was actually Colleen Boyle, who's an excellent epidemiologist at CDC, who said, you know, all the evidence we have doesn't support the hypothesis that MMR causes autism. But she couldn't say it, right? She couldn't say MMR doesn't cause autism, which to Dan Burton sounded like she was waffling, or worse, like she was covering something up. And he just screamed at her. I mean, I was sitting right next to her when this happened. And, you know, he just screamed at her. So you can't tell me that MMR doesn't cause autism because you just don't know, do you? And that's the problem. Problem with us as scientists trying to communicate science to the public and being rigorous and faithful to the scientific method is I think we have to realize that at some level how we sound influences how people perceive what we're saying, which is to say, I think you have to be willing to say MMR doesn't cause autism because it doesn't any more than I can fly, at least not without a plane. So I think we have to get over this.
So what you're saying is you're leaving a back door open that you can still fly someday.
You know, you never know. Definitely you do know.
So why is the public seduced by celebrity? Why do they listen to the anti-vaccine beliefs of people who are not scientists, but who are instead people like musicians, actors, athletes, etc.?
Again, because first of all, they're often trained to be very interactive with the media. They're attractive. They're well-spoken. I mean, if you watch Jenny McCarthy on these shows like Larry King Live or like Oprah Winfrey, she's the attractive, dramatic, well-spoken person that's there, often crying when she's talking about what happened to her, what she believed happened to her son. And you know, that's not something you're used to competing with. As a scientist, what you're used to is going to a scientific conference whereby you and the other scientists share data and you try and come to some reasonable conclusion based on their data, those data. That's not what this is about. This is politics. This is acting. And it's something you're not good at. And I think that's where we often fail. If you watch, for example, Jenny McCarthy on Larry King Live, and there was one episode where she was on with just a wonderful pediatrician from North Carolina named David Taylor, who at the time was the president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and it was hard to watch. I mean, she was much more vivid, much more dramatic. He was literally really back on his heels trying to deal with that onslaught. And you know, and so the public is I think convinced by a person who who's used to acting as distinct from the pediatrician in this case, who isn't.
Can you talk a bit about how the public and media struggle to distinguish real experts from fake experts?
Yeah, I don't think they struggle to distinguish. I don't think the public struggles to distinguish real experts from fake experts. I think they just look at how the person sounds, how they appear, the way that they phrase things. And to them, the person who says it in the most convincing way is the person who's right. I think that they're not looking deeply to see, you know, what that person's background is. Do they have an expertise? Do they have experience? Have they published on the subject? I don't think they're looking at that. They're just looking at how the person positions themselves during their talk. And that's all that matters. I mean, just, you know, look at the current president of the United States. I mean, he, at least to some, sounds very convincing. He sounds like he knows what he's talking about when obviously for most things he doesn't.
What are some of the reasons we might not have touched on already that might cause the public to believe health advice that is just wrong? Can you talk about things like social media and political leanings?
Well, sure. I think also you know, you tend to trust people who you know. So in the case of celebrities, you believe you know them. In the case of friends and chat rooms and social media, you believe that these are the people who you know and therefore are more likely to give you advice that's correct. I do think that the degree to which there's a politics to this, it's interesting for vaccines because I don't think there is a politics to vaccines. I mean, both sides get it wrong. On the right, it's more of a libertarian approach. So government off my back. The thinking is the government doesn't need to tell me whether or not I should inject my child with a biological fluid against my will and my child's will. They don't need to tell me that. I will do my own research. I will figure out what's best for my child, and what is best for my child will be what's best for society. Where that argument falls apart is that how do you get information? I mean, how are you learning about that vaccine? If you're choosing not to vaccinate, you're not doing a very good job of educating yourself about vaccines because vaccines are safe and effective. So you're getting information from where? From the internet, from chat rooms, from other sources of social media, which, you know, can be wrong and cause you to make a bad decision for your child that puts not only your child at risk, but those with whom your child comes in contact with at risk. On the left side for vaccines, it's more of a kind of all natural, bib overall, crunchy granola, you know, back to nature thing. And I'm not going to inject my child with, you know, with something that's quote unquote unnatural, which is remarkable to me. I mean, I don't know who Mother Nature's public relations team is, but I got to figure it out so I can hire them. I mean, Mother Nature can and will kill you and routinely has. The only reason that we live 30 years longer than we did 100 years ago is because we fought back against Mother Nature, who, you know, tries to kill us with viruses, tries to kill us with bacteria, tries to kill us with unsanitary water. I mean, for which we've made vaccines, we've made antibiotics, we have much more sanitary and hygienic water because we fought back against Mother Nature. I don't know why people are so taken, seduced by this word natural when, at least in my world, which is the world of infectious diseases, natural is the last thing you want.
That's one thing I found to be super weird about the anti-vaccine movement, if you will. It's the only issue I can think of where you have people on both, like the far left and the far right, who are on the same page for very different reasons, but they both... you know, I grew up in rural Iowa and then went to University of Iowa, which is, you know, a more liberal town. And I have, you know, friends and stuff that I've known who on Facebook, you know, you see the people on both extremes posting the anti-vaccine articles on social media. And it's crazy just how extremely opposite they are, but they both agree on that. It's the only issue I can think of like that.
I agree with you. They seem to come together on this issue for different reasons. And it's not hard to find like-minded people on the internet. I think that's one thing the internet offers as compared to, say, when I was growing up, where if you were part of a small, relatively fringe group that in this case wasn't science-based, you'd have trouble finding like-minded people. Now, it's not hard at all.
Can you talk a bit about Focus on the Family and the HPV vaccine?
Right. I was actually on the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices when we first started to discuss the HPV or human papillomavirus vaccine. And the George W. Bush administration actually insisted on having someone represent Focus on the Family to be on that committee. The thinking was, and it's obviously not, again, science-based, the thinking was is that if you give an HPV vaccine, which is a vaccine that prevents a disease that is transmitted really solely by sexual contact, that what you're going to be doing is promoting promiscuous sex. That was the thinking. Now, there have been studies by Robert Bednarczyk and others showing that those who get the HPV vaccine are no more likely to engage in sexual activity as they get older than those who aren't, because this is a vaccine that's given to the 11 to 13 year old at a time before most people have had sex, that you're not more likely to be promiscuous, which makes perfect sense. First of all, because the HPV vaccine only prevents against HPV infections, and frankly, not all strains of HPV infections. It certainly doesn't protect against chlamydia or gonorrhea or syphilis or other sexually transmitted diseases like herpes. So the notion that you would then think after getting an HPV vaccine that you could be promiscuous because you were protected against all sexually transmitted diseases was silly. And frankly, as silly as noting that you know, now that I've gotten my tetanus vaccine, I can run across a bed of, you know, rusty nails with impunity. I mean, that's not true either. So it never made sense. But that's where it was coming from. And frankly, that hasn't gone away. If you look at, Betsy DeVos is at least at some level connected to Focus on the Family. And if you Mike Pence, when he was governor of Indiana, it made it very difficult for his then health commissioner, who was Jerome Adams, who now is the Surgeon General of the United States, to have his immunization coordinators promote HPV vaccine for that reason. So I just find that actually outrageous. I mean, Mike Pence, who sets himself up as a religious man, in theory, all religions teach us to care about our children, care about our families, care about our communities. His attempts, frankly, to make it very difficult to give a cancer-preventing vaccine to children was a utterly unreligious thing to do, and I wish he'd been called on it more than he was.
So you've been in the media quite a bit over the years, on television, radio, things like that. What are some of the lessons you've learned from your media appearances over the years?
Well, I can tell you they're all hard-earned. my media training basically involved being on the media and learning how to do this. I guess the obvious ones are that, you know, you don't have to answer the question exactly as asked. That was certainly one of my hardest lessons. I remember it. It was at a local Fox News channel in Philadelphia in the mid-1990s. And, you know, the other lesson here was, I think, be comfortable. But I was asked to be on this show. It was September. It was back to school month. I thought this is going to be great. I can educate about vaccines. But the producer didn't want me to actually sit next to the two anchors actually in the studio. She wanted me to be in the newsroom because she thought that would be more vibrant, more interesting. So I didn't actually see the people who were asking me questions. And she gave me an earpiece, which didn't fit particularly well. And everybody was sort of buzzing around in the newsroom, sort of talking and laughing. And one guy was screaming. The cameraman was actually just right in front of my face, just about 4 feet away. I was on this high, relatively unstable chair. The segment after mine was going to be about this legal comedy drama that was based in Boston called Ally McBeal, which starred Calista Flockhart. But some of the women who were lawyers in that show wore short skirts, which this producer thought was really interesting. So she had four models, all in their early 20s, standing next to me, each wearing progressively shorter skirts. So I wasn't sure exactly how I could have been any more distracted at that point. I guess it was hard to hear. The earpiece fell out. The people in the newsroom were sort of loud. Models were talking. And when I put the earpiece back in after it had fallen out, the question was, Dr. Raffitt, could you tell us what vaccines children get and when they get them? I mean, that's a hard question to answer. You know, there's 10 different vaccines in the mid-1990s. They were all given at different intervals. And I didn't the right answer to that question would be children get a variety of vaccines to prevent diseases like hepatitis, meningitis, bloodstream infections. It's important that parents make sure that children get the vaccines that they need. The parents make sure that children get those vaccines. I didn't give that answer because I was somehow wedded to the notion that you had to answer the question exactly as asked. So I started to list each vaccine and what the intervals were. I kind of got lost in the middle and eventually just kind of sputtered to an end. And it was so bad, actually, it was pathetic. I mean, it was so bad that the models stopped talking and stared at me sadly. It's bad.
And you actually even turned down the opportunity to be on Oprah with Jenny McCarthy.
Right. Oprah had – that was actually Jenny McCarthy's entrance into the world of being an anti-vaccine advocate. She was on Oprah she launched Jenny McCarthy, much as Oprah launched Mehmet Oz. Right. She asked me to be on that show, and I made the right decision there. I think you can't go on a show where the host isn't on your side. Jenny believed that her child's autism was caused by vaccines, although it's not clear her son actually had autism. And, you know, she tells a compelling story on that show. You know, my child was fine. I went to the doctor's office. He pulled out this shot, and I said to him, that's the autism shot, isn't it? And he said no, and he screamed at me, and then my child got this vaccine. And within moments, the soul left his eyes, she said, you know, while fighting back tears. And although, you know, as a scientist, you think, first of all, nothing works that fast. I mean, you know, it's vaccine vaccines certainly don't induce an immune response within moments. There's nothing that would cause one to, how could one even biologically imagine that autism would be caused within moments? And here's all these scientific studies that have shown that MMR doesn't cause autism. But, you know, that's not what this Oprah's about. Oprah's there to tell a story. Her story has three roles. There's the hero, the victim, and the villain. Jenny's the hero. Her son is the victim. This leaves only one role for you, villain. You're just there to tell Jenny that she's wrong. She knows what the cause of autism is. Vaccines, you don't, even though that's not correct. Still, that's what she believes. She has a series of cures for autism. You don't. And not to be completely politically incorrect, it just doesn't look very good for, you know, a guy to go on a show and tell two women that they're wrong in front of a studio audience of 100% women. It was a loser. Fortunately, I didn't go on that show, but I thought about it.
In the book, you say that debating the undebatable is worthwhile. What do you mean by that? And what is the importance of this in the age of digital media?
Yeah, you know, it's my opinion. I don't know if I'm right about this. Certainly Richard Dawkins, who is a far more accomplished scientist than I am, doesn't agree with this point of view. Do you debate the undebatable, the scientifically undebatable? So do you debate somebody who's an anti-vaccine activist on a national news show? Do you debate somebody who believes in homeopathy, even for disorders for which there actually are conventional treatments? I mean, do you debate someone who's a creationist? Do you debate a Holocaust denier? And my initial feeling on this was that Richard Dawkins' feeling, which was don't, because all it does is it sort of raises the level of respectability of the other side. It gives oxygen to another side that needs it badly. But I've come around on that after watching people like Michael Shermer debate Mark Weber, who's a Holocaust denier, watching Bill Nye, the science guy, debate Ken Ham at the Creation Museum in Kentucky. I mean, those YouTube videos of those debates have had millions of viewers. And as I watched those debates, I really learned a lot about those issues. Similarly, when Joe Schwartz debated Andre Sain, who's a homeopath at McGill University, I learned a lot about homeopathy and how one would debate it if you could. So I do think the debater on the side of science has to sort of look beyond the person they're debating, who obviously they're not going to convince, or in the case of Michael Shermer, look beyond the people that are in front of them. Shermer did this debate at the Institute for Historical Review, which is basically just the center of Holocaust denialism in Newport Beach, California, and look at beyond that and think, how am I going to be viewed if this is on YouTube? And same thing if you're on chat rooms. Often if you're on a chat room and you provide information that is counter to the bad information that's out there, although you're not going to convince that person, you do provide information to others. So I do think it's worth it. I just think emotionally it's really hard to do.
Can you talk a bit about some of your experiences on late night TV?
Yes. I get up very early in the morning, so I would never survive on late night TV. The good news is the Colbert Report is actually taped much earlier. So it's actually not for me late night. Yeah, so I was on the Colbert Report a couple times. And I think we need to do that. I think as scientists, we need to do that. First of all, there is no group that has been better at defending science than the comedians. So the comedians, they're skeptics. They're trained to see nonsense and to react to it. So people like Penn and Teller, John Oliver, Stephen Colbert, Samantha Bee, Jimmy Kimmel have all been excellent on science and confronting, frankly, science denialism and scientific illiteracy. So to their credit. So I do think scientists need to do that, even though it's incredibly uncomfortable. I had to the first time I was on the Colbert Report, you know, Colbert meets with you backstage, and he's great. I mean, he tells you that he's going to play a character, that he's not going to step out of character, that he needs you to attack him. He needs you to attack that character. Realize you're not attacking him, you're just attacking a character he plays. Frankly, he says, I believe you. I agree with you, because his father, as it turns out, was a doctor who had an expertise in infectious diseases and immunology in the South, in South Carolina, where Stephen Colbert grew up. And so he's very sympathetic to science. And you just have to be able to sort of hang in there for that. Although the second time I was in the Colbert Report was the hardest time. I mean, the last question he asked me, he said, well, so, you know, you're in the pocket of industry. How do you respond to it? Because, you know, when we created the rotavirus vaccine at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, you know, we weren't going to make that in our lab. Only the pharmaceutical industry has the resources and expertise to actually do the research and development that could make that a product. And so, he asked me that question. It's a question I commonly get asked. And, so my first answer when he said, you know, you're in the pocket of the industry, I said, you know, at Children's Hospital, we're not in the pocket of the industry. If anything, we're in the pocket of children because we do these good things for children. And the studio audience booed. So here's like a couple hundred people loudly booing on national television. Not a very good feeling. But he was great, Colbert. He gave me a second chance. He said, that's not the answer you want. We'll try this again. We're going to go out with this answer. And so he asked me the question a second time. And I said, you know, you can't on the one hand praise vaccines for being safe and effective and not praise those who make them safe and effective. And then I did something you're specifically told never to do, which is I looked at the studio audience and I said, was that any better? And they cheered. And then when it was in the final cut, because it's not a live show, it's live tape, as they say, so it's edited. You had basically me answering that question that way and then essentially saying something nice about the pharmaceutical industry, or at least vaccine makers, and then people cheering, which probably has never happened before. When I was out of the studio, I asked the associate producer, why did people boo when I said, you know, that we were in, that I was in the pocket of children? And she said that people like you don't realize that you're on a comedy show. When you said you were in the pocket of children, it made you sound like a pedophile. I can safely say I never imagine that when we were taking the cab back to the train station in New York to go back to Philadelphia that night. My wife and daughter were with me, and I said to them, you know, could you ever imagine that that's how people would have interpreted that? And my daughter said, yeah, I imagine. That's why I booed.
Can you talk a bit about Andrew Wakefield? Even though he's been discredited, people still refer to his work. Can you talk about this and why people still believe it?
So the nicest thing you could say about Andrew Wakefield was that when he published his paper in 1998 in the journal Lancet, claiming that the combination MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine caused autism, that he raised the hypothesis. Now, the paper consisted of 12 children, 8 of whom had autism and whose autism symptoms developed within a month of getting that vaccine. Now, at the time, the incidence of autism in the United Kingdom was roughly 1 per 2,000 children. About 90% of children got the MMR vaccine. Most children with autism were diagnosed between 1 and 2 years of age, which is roughly when they got the vaccine. So statistically, you would have expected that every year about 300 children would develop signs and symptoms of autism within a month of getting the vaccine, unless the vaccine prevented autism, which it didn't. It only prevented measles, mumps, rubella infection. And he sort of built his hypothesis on a series of, frankly, impossible events. You know, that the MMR vaccine overwhelmed the immune system, that measles vaccine virus destroyed the intestine, that allowed brain-damaging proteins to enter the lymphatics and bloodstream and cross an intact blood-brain barrier and cause autism, none of which made any sense, for which he had no evidence. And as it turns out, he actually misrepresented clinical and biological data anyway. So the paper was in many ways a fraud. But in any case, you could argue in best case scenario, he raised the hypothesis. And so people responded. I mean, the academic community responded. The public health community responded by doing studies, looking at children who did or didn't get that vaccine, making sure you controlled for other things like socioeconomic background, a healthcare-seeking behavior, medical background, so you could isolate the effect of that one variable, which is to say receipt of the MMR vaccine. And when that study was done over and over again, now 17 times in 7 different countries on 3 different continents involving now millions of children, the results have always been the same. MMR doesn't cause autism. Still, he persists. He persists in that belief. And I think what draws some people to him, and not many, I really do think he's been marginalized at this point, even though he's apparently now dating Elle Macpherson, you know, the Australian actress and model. After having divorced his long-suffering wife, Carmel, I mean, after she puts up with all of this stuff for like 2 decades, he then, you know, sort of jettisons her for this actress and model. But in any case, you know, he I think to some people represents kind of a guru, you know, he's immutable in his belief. He's unchanging in his belief, whereas science, you know, is constantly sort of questioning itself and moving forward in fits and starts. People like him, at least a segment of the population are attractive, like Mehmet Oz or Deepak Chopra, because they don't express that. They come off as a guru. We like that. We like certainty when often we know there's none, I think, or little. I think, you know, if you ask people whether we'll know more about science and medicine 100 years from now than we know, I think everybody would say yes. But when it comes to your disease, your problem, you'd like to believe that we know everything we need to know right now, even when that's often not the case.
Now, you were actually called to testify in a congressional hearing opposite Wakefield, right? Can you talk a bit about this?
Yeah, that's right. It was in 2000. It was Dan Burton's committee hearing, the Office of Government Reform. Burton's grandson had been diagnosed with autism. Burton was of the belief that the autism was caused by a vaccine. And he sort of set up a series of doctors, including Andrew Wakefield, to sort of support that belief. But, you know, the Democratic majority, the Democratic minority head at that time was Henry Waxman, who was a very much pro-science, very much good science, very supportive of the National Institutes of Health. So he insisted that the other panels consist of, you know, real scientists. So I had a chance to watch this play out. It was really demoralizing. I mean, you'd like to believe that. I don't know why you'd like to believe. Well, you'd like to believe it, even though you know at some level it's not true, that, you know, that when they have these congressional hearings, that it's about getting information to help best form policy that can best help the public. But that's really not what this was. This was a circus. It was a show. Dan Burton was running the show. He believed that vaccines caused autism, and that's what he wanted this show to be. The jury in this case was the American public. And when you watch the way it all played out, it was pretty demoralizing because Dan Burton didn't care what the other side had to say, or said another way, the side that supported science. He was just going to try and get his point of view out there. The science be damned. And it was hard to watch. Certainly the public didn't benefit from all the money that was spent on that committee hearing.
What do you mean when you say in your book that it can be a godsend to have someone like Wakefield on the other side?
Right. So I think, you know, Andrew Wakefield wasn't just wrong. He was fraudulent and wrong. I mean, he misrepresented clinical and biological data. He, unknown to his co-authors, had received hundreds of thousands of dollars to basically launder legal claims through a medical journal. And I think when that all came to light, his paper was retracted. Frankly, more for the ethical violations of that paper than from the data. When you think about it, you know, there's 6,500 medical and scientific journals in the world. There's 4,000 medical and scientific papers published every day in the world's literature. And so they follow, not surprisingly, a bell-shaped curve. Some studies are excellent. Some are awful. And most are more or less mediocre. You really have to work to get a paper retracted. I mean, you have to basically be fraudulent to get a paper retracted, which is what he was. So I think the media rejected him, frankly, by, 2011. I think his last farewell on the stage of mainstream media was on Anderson Cooper's 360, where Cooper really tore into him. And since then, he's been marginalized. I mean, he'll appear on, places like the Alex Jones show, this sort of rabid conspiracy theorist show. But for the most part, he's been rejected by mainstream media. So I think that's good. I'm not so sure it would have worked that way had he not been fraudulent.
Now, you've kind of put yourself in the crosshairs of the anti-vaccine movement. You've said that you've had angry letters, calls for your firing, and even death threats. Can you talk a bit about this?
Yeah, I think that that when you put yourself into the middle of a cultural controversy, you're going, if not in this case, a scientific controversy, you're going to get pushback, and it can get really mean. I've certainly been physically harassed while walking into a CDC meeting. I've had three, what the FBI considered to be legitimate death threats. And so you have to decide whether or not you want to live with that. And for me, it's not a choice. I'm compelled to do this because there's not a year that goes by in our hospital. We don't see a child admitted who either suffers from or dies from a vaccine-preventable disease. Invariably, it's because the parent chose not to vaccinate them. Invariably, it's because they got bad information from these anti-vaccine websites. So you have to fight against this. I mean, it's just the right thing to do, and so you have to do it because otherwise you're leaving these children vulnerable, and that's just unconscionable. So be it. I don't think that that they're going to kill me. If they are, they're not going to give me a heads up first, which is what I guess is comes to me in these pretty much weekly emails that I get from people that have called me pretty much everything from Satan to, the usual Nazi analogies.
How much hate mail would you say you get on a monthly basis, out of curiosity?
It's actually getting better. It used to be on a daily basis. I would say now, yeah, maybe it's a few every month that I get. Then I print them out and I put them in my hate mail file just in case something bad happens. My wife knows where the hate mail file, so this can be a lead for people. But I honestly don't think this is going to happen. I'm sure I'm working on a lot of denial. But, I mean, how many sort of pro-vaccine people have been killed by the anti-vaccine movement? But I think that answer is none. So I think I'm good.
Well, I would like for you to offer some advice to some of the listeners who may not come from a scientific background. Listeners who may have friends or family members pushing anti-vaccine propaganda on them. Listeners who may see anti-vaccine articles being shared all over their friends, social media accounts. Listeners who may have developed a little bit of a concern about are some of these vaccines bad? Where can they go to find unbiased, reliable information to ease their mind?
So I think that professional groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, I think, you know, hospitals and universities, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, the Mayo Clinic, and others have good information about health and medicine and science. I think in order to reject things like vaccines, frankly, you have to be a conspiracy theorist. You have to believe that thousands and thousands of clinicians and nurses and nurse practitioners and researchers are all sort of in league simply to line their pockets and that they've been willing to lie about vaccine efficacy and vaccine safety for decades, which, you know, is just a little hard to believe. At least it should be hard to believe. But I think, you know, the other thing is when you go to these sites that sort of make these outrageous claims, they're invariably selling something, you know, whether it's medicines to treat autism or to treat other things for which medicine has little to offer. So I think that you should be very suspicious of that. I do think it's reasonable to be skeptical about vaccines as it's reasonable to be skeptical about anything you put in your body. So educate yourself. But that should allow you to be able to ask much better questions to your healthcare professional and expect good answers from your healthcare professional. Certainly vaccines, like any medical product, are not absolutely safe, but, you know, the benefits of the vaccines clearly and definitively outweigh their risks. And this should be able to enable you to ask better questions. But I do think really to reject vaccines or to reject evolution or to reject climate change, frankly, you have to be a conspiracy theorist, and you know, there's no fighting that. You know, if you believe that the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, which advises the CDC, or the so-called Vaccine-Related Biological Product Approval Committee, which advises the FDA on vaccines, that those two groups are just deeply in the pocket of the industry, well, if that's true, then in theory, they know something you don't. They know that vaccines really aren't safe. They know that vaccines really aren't effective. Well, that's true. Why do they vaccinate their children or their grandchildren? Because they all do. I mean, if you actually interview people who are on these committees, and I was on that committee for 5 years, the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices. Now I'm on an FDA committee. These people are all sort of, you know, generally well-trained with an expertise and experience in that particular field. And they're also vaccinating their own children. So that should tell you everything you need to know.
Well, Paul, I've taken up a lot of time, a lot of your time today. My final question for you is, what are you working on now?
So I'm actually working on another book that's, it's kind of like, I think the pendulum in medicine has swung too far in overdiagnosis and overtreatment. And so I'm trying to, write a book that, goes sort of, there are 20 things that I think is advice that you're soon going to be hearing, but don't hear yet. So things like don't treat fever because fever is an important part of the immune response, or you don't have to finish your antibiotic course. Why have a set amount of time that's determined at the beginning of illness when in fact, once you start to feel better, you can assume that you have treated your infection, which I think is generally true. You know, the vitamin D craze, which I think, frankly, is not just misguided, but is a hoax. I think suddenly half the country is vitamin D deficient. That's not true. And those sorts of things. Let's say a sort of skeptical book about I think where medicine has overreached in some ways.
That sounds great. When it's finished, I'd love to have you back on the show. I'd like to thank you again for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and it was an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Take care.
Thank you, Jeremy.